funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Jim Crusoe. He's the author of a first novel, Iceland, published by Dalkey Archive Press. He's written a book of short stories as well, Blood Lake. This is a very unusual book, funny and melancholic, unpredictable, I would say almost by turns, and I thought it would be a good idea for listeners to hear the opening passage of Iceland before we begin to talk. This is Jim Crusoe reading the opening passage from Iceland, published by Dalkey Archive.
I'd been dying little by little and bit by bit, I thought. On some days I felt fine, as if the animal or machine or whatever I was at that moment could easily believe that the whole thing, this dying business, had only been a bad dream, although a waking one, to be sure, which had somehow leaked into my mind while I was waiting at a street corner for a traffic light, as all around me cars went about their business, their exhaust spewing into my lungs, their radios hurting my ears. But the catch was that they would continue on doing this forever, and I would not. My name, by the way, is Paul. But then the light would change and I would be somewhere else, in a pet store or sitting on a stool in a piano bar, and I'd been wrong. I was fine until the next time I blinked again, when there it would be back and grinning. So I'd been suffering for a long time in one way or the other, and at last it seemed as if the end was growing near. I'd finally given up resistance to the idea of going through life carrying someone else's organ inside of me, and either the procedure would work or it wouldn't. So it was on Dr. Perlman's advice I finally boarded the big blue bus that passed by the institute where I was supposed to, as he put it, look the organs over and find one that I liked. Then came the first surprise. No sooner had I stepped off the bus straight onto a rolled-up newspaper than I twisted my ankle, and when I looked up, I saw the place looked like nothing I'd imagined. I checked the address. When Dr. Perlman had mentioned that the institute was housed in a former villa, I pictured something out of Pompeii, light and airy, full of vines, with maybe even a baby volcano looming in the background. But there it was, right in the middle of town, built on classic lines but of dull gray granite, dark and solid, next to an ice-making plant, and surrounded not by vines but heavy leafless trees, their arms stretched hopelessly toward the sun. Worse, its narrow windows looked as if they'd been stabbed into the walls by a knife or possibly an axe, and its corners were anchored by four huge stones like four heavy cenotaphs yet to be inscribed. The overall effect, it seemed to me at that moment, was that the whole building was slowly sinking into the ground.
It's not long before Paul discovers that the organs he's to look over are housed in a pool with a beautiful girl, Emily.
A nymph who
superintends them. And I thought it would be interesting as well for you to hear the initial description of those organs. It's on the bottom of page 3 of Iceland.
I stepped inside and inhaled. In addition to the salt, I could also catch the semeny odor of chlorine. Turned out I was standing next to a red bucket of bleach. Then I blinked because I had not been prepared in the least for what I saw next. There, 20 feet away, within the blue tiled borders of the pool, were the very organs I'd come to visit. The bloated, spongy butterflies of lungs, the shy parenthesis of kidneys, the lurid exclamation marks of livers, the cheerful blimps of stomachs, the loopy daydreams of intestines, the schools of tiny pancreas and dark, brooding spleens all drifting across the pool's still surface like floaters along the back of an eyeball, all sleeping in their Olympic-sized waterbed, dreaming.
Jim Crusoe, reading from Iceland. Now, at what level is the reader meant to take the reality of this book? In other words, are the things that Paul is telling us strictly true? Is his voice a given?
Well, that's in a way what the whole book is about, is trying to decide at what level you're going to take it. Some are true and some are not. Some are things that Paul believes. Some are things that he wants to believe. And some of them may be literary fabrications that the author is putting in there. So in funny ways, writing for this book for me was negotiating those questions and never really coming to an end. I'm not absolutely certain, for what it's worth, what happens at the end. And I've had three or four people tell me different ideas about it.
Well, it's interesting because he asks the reader repeatedly throughout the book to believe him.
Exactly.
And he even sometimes says, you'll never believe what happened next. And it's almost as if he wants to gain some kind of external referent for his own experiences by... It's almost like, how am I doing, coach?
Yeah, I think he's hypnotizing himself into belief in a certain way that we all do. I mean, we all want to believe that the world is as we see it. And at the same time, there's a large part of us that says, of course it's not. But we say, we're having a good time, aren't we? And of course, we may be.
Well, he is a virtually about-to-be-extinct man. Not only are his organs undergoing degeneration, or one organ, although he won't tell us which, he is by profession, trained by perfectionists, he says, a typewriter repairman, which, as we know, leaves him virtually unemployed. He is also, Paul, not a particularly bright bulb. And so what he sees around him are, he suspects, the result of a daydream or a waking dream. And he's constantly in a state where he's drawing the most obvious conclusion from very direct evidence. What made you decide to write the way one of my favorite writers, Charles Portis, does, about a living dodo?
Well... I don't know if he's a dodo so much as optimistic, but maybe they're the same thing, you know. In figuring out how to write fiction, one of the things I learned was that it was necessary to have my characters act. And for me, people like Paul are able to run forward where wiser people like myself stand back. And so in a certain way, Paul is the part of me that is the really optimistic part. Paul is the one that picks up something and says, oh, well, let's try this out. Let's push this button and see what happens. And he always thinks it's going to work out well.
Now, you began as a poet. I'm speaking, by the way, to Jim Crusoe, the author of Iceland, published by Dalkey Archive. And this certainly is an entry in what would be called novels by poets, that category. But it's a certain kind of poetry. It's a poetry in which things were invented almost as quickly as they were thought up, appeared on the page, and then die at the end of a very short poem. A universe run amok and then briskly curtailed. Nowadays, you mostly write prose. What led you from one to the other, and why did you choose prose?
Well, it really goes back to Paul again. Prose narrative requires, to my mind, requires things happening. Poetry requires a state of mind, and they're not exactly the same. But narrative for me, definition, is a character moving in time, and that really is about change. That's about... Mm-hmm. Finding yourself in a place that's different than you began. And poetry, you don't have to do that. So this is a novel about by a poet, but one of the specifications of that is that this is a novel which is trying to figure out how to write a novel as it goes along. That is to say, it's trying to extend itself. It's like trying to build a bridge across a chasm from only one side. So you just keep nailing – in a cartoon, you just keep nailing on slats and pray that you're going to make it over.
Now, Who is doing the inventing, Paul or the novelist?
Both.
Uh-huh. So it's a kind of collaboration between the imagination of the novelist, which is kind of complicated and fecund, abundant, full of whim, and Paul, whose own, you call him an optimist, but my own sense is that his feeling is it will either happen or not. As he says about replacing his organs, the process will either take or it won't. He's kind of resigned to whatever happens. So it's as if here is this normal guy told by a doctor to get a new organ, repairing typewriters, an ordinary life, in a sense, gets sick, fixes things. There's this novelist behind him kind of murmuring weird ideas into the microphone above the novel that he can cause to materialize at any moment. And Paul's, in a way, impulse is to resist invention.
Yeah, well, Paul's only has one idea, really, and he has two. The first one is to fix typewriters for the rest of his life because he thinks that's the purest and most beautiful profession in the world. And the second one is somehow to find Emily. And in between, a volcano intervenes, a marriage intervenes, a long affair with a woman who runs a bar intervenes, as well as several years of state prison. But he's unfazed by all of this, you see, because he has a single idea. So in a funny way that this novel is a dialogue between me, the novelist, who is saying it's impossible to have a single idea. You can't do that and go anywhere in life. And Paul, who's trying his best to do that. He really just wants to go from point A to point B. And so it's this, in a way, it's a question because I spent so many years of my life wishing that I could be sure of just one thing.
I'm speaking to Jim Crusoe about his novel Iceland, published by Dalkey Archive. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, lest listeners think that this is a meta-novel, the character of the novelist never appears within the book. It's just that Paul is faced with such a blitzkrieg of rapid-fire catastrophe, and his own nature is so sedentary and, in a way, so foursquare that you get the implicit sense that, like a character in a cartoon who says, what is that mean cartoonist going to think of next, this guy has been trapped in the world of a particular kind of invention. But that's not different from those of us who are trapped in this world and its catastrophes and its rapid-fire changes, so that however wild this book gets, it's still a version of what happens to all of us. In other words, it's not, in a sense, an imaginative novel. It's a novel that mirrors the hopelessness of daily experience and its surprise.
Yeah, and it's a really traditional novel, actually, because it's a boy after girl novel. It's got a very, very straightforward shape to it. Someone meets someone. They're crazy about them. They take that person deep into their imagination after possibly only 4 hours, and that person remains there for 20 years. And things happen in ways that deter and deflect the quest of this guy, but he's still on his quest, sure.
To what extent do you think this novel is autobiographical?
In two ways. One is the obvious way is that the character who is I like to sort of describe them as complete idiots, but fondly. So are very much like the other part of me that I don't allow into public, the kind that is always thinking only of himself and that things are going to work out and why not push the button and see what happens, that sort of buried cartoon self. And the second is this question, and it seems to be – it's come out slowly in my work, much to my surprise. But the question of – a Platonic question. If we have something we really idealize, if there's something we think we're going toward, whether it's a woman or a man or a face or a place, and we never see it again, what really is it? What really is it that keeps us going? If there's a the autobiographical part was that, yeah, I had a girlfriend that I was deeply, deeply in love with. I haven't seen her forever. I don't even have any pictures of this woman. Yet there is this thing I'm carrying around in my mind that in a funny way I have no idea what it is. I couldn't draw it. I couldn't say it. I couldn't do anything about it. And yet somehow I'm cherishing this. So it's very strange to me.
Now, I want to examine another aspect of the book, because just as the character goes from a small apartment to Iceland to the bottom of a glacial river to a volcano to the site where Iceland's contemporary epic poet lies buried at the center of a glacier.
Entombed in a glacier.
Yes, entombed in a glacier. Now, just as he's moving from setting to setting, the writing seems to move from set piece to set piece as well. And it seems to be, I've told friends that this is a novel in which someone blunders into a constantly changing cartoon, almost like a Raymond Roussel novel. It's like a big dumbhead who finds himself caught in the contraptions of the avant-garde novel. So I wanted to talk to you about some of those contraptions and get a better idea about how the book is structured.
Sure. It's someone who just says, why can't life be simple? And but life obviously isn't so simple. So go ahead. Tell you, I had a vision of this book long before I began it, the actual writing of it, which was not so avant-garde but maybe organic, of a sheet like one's mother used to dry in the sun, draped over five or six clothes poles so that the sheet was held up, but it was like a tent in a way. But instead of one stake down the middle, it had lots of them, so it had a lot of different bumps to it. So that the primary structure of this novel in some ways is to have this narrative sheet or narrative arc, but instead of it being a smooth one, it's constantly punctuated by the clothes poles, which in this case, I have to say, came from a wonderful book of poetry that I was reading at the time. I think it's called With Each Clouded Peak by Frederica May Rocker. And the interesting thing was, every time I would get stuck in the novel trying to figure out what's going to happen next, because I don't know, even though it seems like it, it should be obvious, it's not, what's going to happen next, I would open the book of poetry, and there I would find a fabulous phrase or three or four words just sticking out at me out of that poem, and that would allow me to write yet another digression. So that this is a book where you have both obsession and common sense sort of fighting, but you also have the need to tell a story with the need to stop telling the story and digress it.
Now, I notice that Paul, our hero, by the end of the novel is building a grave, presumably for himself, and it is next to the grave of the wife of the rug cleaner whose name was Valerie. Mm-hmm. There's a famous poet named Paul Valery. Why does this enter the novel?
Well, the famous poet has a famous poem, something like At the Marine Cemetery. And notice that it ends in a cemetery, right? I don't know. This is a sort of an extra structural game that I play, I think, to keep myself interested. Strictly speaking, it didn't have to be Paul Valery. But in fact, I do paraphrase part of that poem in the final scene. And that is something that I need to do, I think, to keep myself interested. Does it have bigger significance than that? I don't know. Emily Dickinson was in this book, too, but she got axed.
Are there other things like that? Is it a running kind of structure?
Not exactly, but the section I read earlier about the house, about the Institute, that in fact was modeled in a way at the after the opening of Wuthering Heights. and I do that partly to give myself prompts but partly to slow the pace down because, as you say, there is the great definition of cartoons is movement. Things move very rapidly. So for me, one of the things I learn I'm learning through writing, is how to slow that thing down and how to make it stop.
Now, why would one want to slow it down? In cartoons, one wants it to move as quickly as possible.
I have a theory that I have not yet actually been able to try out, but I believe that if you wish to describe beauty, it's almost always still. It's almost always a still scene I'm describing, and I don't know why that is. I think of Sebald's writing, as you know, and also those still pictures he puts in there, and I think that there's something in the stillness that makes it untouchable, whereas when we have motion in writing, it tends to lower the sensibility. And until you lower it down to a cartoon, although I think cartoons are pretty interesting because, after all, Flannery O'Connor wrote them.
In what sense?
In the sense that her characters are not introspective. Her characters are not deeply drawn. And those stories are wonderful because, well, her characters are allegories. They move on little sticks.
Oh, well, I was just hoping when you said that Flannery O'Connor wrote cartoons.
Yeah, I know.
That you
like
meant
the crazy
it literally. The Flannery O'Connor, Pluto, and Mickey Mouse, the famous one where they sell him to the...
to the circus. For the state pen.
yeah. Oh, well, my disappointment. but tell me, when you're working on this, now you mentioned Sebald, and you're not very far into Sebald before you recognize that he wants his rhythms and his sense of the world to be kind of autumnal, crepuscular, solemn, dignified, and almost with the first pages, you say, this is prose that the author wants to see last.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got, in a way, the opposite sensibility. This is a jalopy that's falling apart, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a car that's breaking down and sputtering and stopping and you're getting out again and metaphors get mixed and then picked up again later, turn momentarily eloquent but fall apart again. What makes a writer want to make a wrong note rag?
I think that This sounds like really ridiculous, but I think that my life is a combination of all those events, of things being serious and not serious and almost stopping and yet going. I mean, I think that it's not as eloquent as the sort of stillness of beauty that we all are maybe headed toward or longing for, but I hate to say it, but it's the way it is. That's what I have to deal with, and I actually can't believe in the fiction of perfection. In a funny way, this book is against the fiction of perfection, as much as it is an homage to someone who desperately wants the fiction of perfection.
Who is that?
Paul.
Paul
wants this. This woman to be this as she always was back in his poor addled memory. And he can't have it, and you can't have it, and I can't have it, and nobody can ever have that. And yet that doesn't slow us down a bit from wanting it.
Now, if a writer wants to create a world that's constantly transient. What stops the book from feeling transient, or does it?
I think possibly the repetition of the action. I think possibly the patterns and possibly the familiarity of the action. In a way, again, it's falling apart, but it's forever falling apart. And in that way, it seems to me exactly the way things are. As I long for that beautiful moment myself, I can't see those without feeling like they're false, really.
So that as you're writing, the permanent moment, the thing that would allow the frame to still and become heroic, strikes you as being fake.
Yes, I write with those two angels on my shoulder, but they're not angels, but maybe they're sort of funny cartoon figures. And one says, you can do it. This will last. This is great. And the other one says, don't be ridiculous. Nothing has. And you know, don't lie to yourself. And so that all these books, all my books, but this book in particular, is this argument between these two guys.
Now, given all of this contention mm-hmm. between the author and the character, between the author and his imps, his demons, mm-hmm. What allows the book to end, because it seems to, with death?
Well, it begins with death too, but it doesn't end. But it doesn't end with death. Okay, it ends with this guy. First of all, I like this guy. Partly because he's so absurd, which I think helps. But he's digging a grave. And you're just the perfect example of somebody having an idea of the way the book ends that I had not in mind. Maybe it's death. He's digging a grave. In fact, he finds an old typewriter spool. But the question is he digging for treasure? Because he's just bought this plot, or is he digging his grave? Well, there's a profound question for everybody every day.
I've been speaking with Jim Crusoe, author most recently of Iceland, published by the Dalkey Archive Press. Thank you for joining me, Jim.
Thank you, Michael.
You can read the first chapter of Iceland on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.